Life is full of personal wins, whether it's cleaning your house, getting that dream car, or checking off your to-do list. Winning at life is a great feeling. And with the State Farm Personal Price Plan, you can keep winning when you create an affordable price just for you by bundling home and auto. So give yourself a round of applause. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself
and for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase.
Welcome to the Nerds Podcast number 905. This episode brought to you by Squarespace. Beautiful templates created by world-class designers. Squarespace makes it easy to turn your idea into a new and unique website in just a few clicks. And their analytics will help you grow in real time. And if you have a question, they have 24/7 customer support that's there to help. Think it, dream it, make it with Squarespace. Make your thing. Head to Squarespace for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, just use the offer code Nerdist to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or a domain. So do it. We'll keep telling you until you make a thing. I always get excited when people go, hey, I made the thing now, finally. Like watching people go off and actually manifest the things that were in their head that will ultimately probably change their lives, Katie Levine. And speaking of which, what can we promote on the Nerdist Community Corkboard?
So Reddit user Mattress Crane says, hey, I'd like to pitch a thing I've been working on for the past 3 years. It's a book that's being collaborated with the subreddit Life of Norman. Essentially, they created a book about a fictional character named Norman. He's a simple man, works in an office, lives with a cat, an entirely normal life. The subreddit's content is little stories written by whoever wants to take a shot at telling an anecdote about Norman. Sometimes it's silly, sometimes it's sad, but it's always relatable. So over the past few years, he's been putting together a large and thoughtfully collected book of these stories called The Book of Norman. You know, he says it's a very odd thing, but it's special and it's about community being nice to one another and knowing it's okay to be normal. 100% of the book's profits are going towards cats' shelters, which I really like. So that's kind of cool. The book is going to be out October 21st and will be available on Amazon. And then Rachel Jackson writes, I wanted to share a Kickstarter for my new project, Jose and the Hawk. It's a buddy cop comedy about a man named Jose and a hawk puppet set in a fictionalized version of the modern-day Seattle. It's very Starsky and Hutch-inspired. Eventually, she'd like to make it into a web series, but right now it's a pilot episode script. They shot a third of it this summer, and so they could know better what people want and what they're talking about. And the Kickstarter's for funds to finish filming the pilot and also building a fan base. So if that sounds like something you're interested in, just go to Kickstarter.com and search Jose and the Hawk.
Excellent. Thank you, Katie Levine. This episode is David X. Cohen, who, of course, was the showrunner behind Futurama, worked on The Simpsons, a brilliant, brilliant man. And we got to make the Futurama podcast. I mean, I got to be in the Futurama podcast, and I got to be voice directed by David, which was a tremendous honor. but that podcast is out now, Radiorama. And then also, download and play Futurama Worlds of Tomorrow, which is on iOS and Android. I was a head in a jar in the game, and I was very excited about that. I was very excited to get to be a head in a jar, Katie. Being a head in the jar was one of the most exciting.
Your life dream?
It kind of was.
It's really cool, and it looks cool, and it looks just like you, which is fun.
They did a great job with it. I think that actually my head in a jar is handsomer than my actual head, but they did a really nice job. But David's a mad genius, and I was so excited to have him on. You know, I mean, Futurama just and The Simpsons, but both. I mean, I can't even quantify what those shows mean to me. So, David was a great guest, and thank you for taking the time to. We've been doing a lot of these at my house. You know, ever since that midnight wrapped, we don't go to the podcast studio much anymore because it's quite frankly easier for me to do them out of my house, and it's been really great. It's just like a nice, relaxed vibe. So thanks for coming over, Katie.
No worries.
You've probably come over to my house way more than you ever wanted to come over to someone's house to record all these. This episode also brought to you by Stamps.com. Going to the post office is a drag. The lines, the aggression, the how does this get mailed? What do I need to do? All the parking, all the crap. So avoid the hassle of the post office and mail everything from postcards, envelopes, packages, domestic or international with Stamps.com. Print it out, no matter what it is, any class, whatever it is, using your computer and your printer. Click print mail, you're done. And unlike the post office, Stamps.com never closes. So there's no lines. Print postage for letters or packages 24/7. They're going to send you a digital scale that calculates the exact postage and then help you decide the best class based on your needs. Then you give it to your mail carrier, and that's it. You're done. You can even get discounts you can't get at the post office. They're going to bring all the services of the postal service right to your fingertips. So enjoy Stamps.com with a special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus postage and a digital scale without long-term commitments. Go to Stamps.com, click the microphone on the top of the homepage, and type in Nerdist. That's Stamps.com, enter the promo code Nerdist. Stamps.com, never go to the post office again. Katie Levine, it is episode 905. David X. Cohen, roll the thing.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Randy used to purposely sometimes leave his phone on because he during DVD commentaries because he thought it'd be funny to take a call during the commentary and have it be forever on. Hello, you're on the commentary. We did that several times.
Yeah, we have a delivery for your house. Yeah. Just take it around the side. That's really funny. Did the person ever comment on? Did they ever say?
I'm not really sure what was going on the other end of the call.
Oh, he didn't put it on speakerphone. Oh, that's really funny.
He would encourage other people to do the same too.
He was really, he's such a lovely guy, and he's always been so, I mean, when I just blindly reached out to you and said, hey, let's do like a radio play of Futurama, because the world needs more Futurama. And I just want to thank you for not telling me to fuck off.
Well, are we already on?
Yeah, it's recording.
We're on? Oh, okay. I used to listen to a lot of old-time radio, just like, you know, The Whistler and mm-hmm. The Shadow and all that kind of stuff. And so it felt like a natural to me to try to do something in that form. You know, these shows were not comedies, but they were always funny anyway.
Right.
Because it's always, what's that in your hand? A gun? It is a gun. You know, like just
click, joke, click.
But it's a class of jokes that you can't make when you're showing what's happening. You know, so it opens up new avenues of attack for writing. So it was kind of fun.
Theater of the mind.
Yeah.
Especially now that, I think there is an appreciation and a resurgence for types of entertainment that aren't so – that don't just give you all of the information, that you actually have to maybe use your imagination from time to time. But with Futurama, it just – you guys broke format so many times on the show that it just seemed like
– I was just thinking about that the other day. You know, Futurama is a show that it benefited very much from the ever-shifting formats that have been taking place the last 15, 20 years.
Yeah.
In the sense that we were on regular old broadcast TV with commercials originally, you know, in our standard definition 4x3 animation.
Right.
And we clung to life for 4 or 5 years that way. And then we were off. And, you know, for all history up to that point, that would have been the end. But no, DVDs were just hitting their stride at that time. And we sold a lot of DVDs after being canceled, which was kind of surprising news to Fox. And then the show went on late night on cable TV, and that was, you know, a new place to look for stuff. And that was a success. So then the show came back for these direct-to-DVD movies, which was a new thing you couldn't have done, you know, 10 years before that.
Right.
And those sold. So then the show came back on the air on Comedy Central, again on cable. And then at that point, we're in HD, in high definition, and widescreen, and various technical improvements. And while that's going, Netflix comes around, and then that keeps the show alive after 4 more years on Comedy Central. We're on Netflix, and now moving to Hulu, by the way.
Oh,
for
nice.
All you angry Netflix subscribers, I apologize, but that's just, you know, Fox is kind of pulled all their stuff off and put it on Hulu.
Coincidentally,
Fox owns part of Hulu. It's just a weird coincidence.
Well, that's a strange... I bet, you know, when they finally finished that deal and they went, hey, you know what we just realized? We also own a piece of this. That's what a crazy, weird...
Just things just work out in your favor.
Life is weird.
Sometimes when you own everything, things work out in your favor. It's one of the strange things.
And people... I'm sure people... then people get pissed at you. Hey, man, what the fuck? Why are you moving this to Netflix? That is way over my pay grade.
Yeah.
I do not make decisions for...
I wouldn't say I'm the last to know, but I'm rather than giving information, being given information, I'm given clues about what's going to happen to the show. So
so basically, Futurama for you is like National Treasure. Like,
so most recently, the clue that we were going to move off Netflix was this, you know, 12 months ago. I don't know. Time is a mystery to me now. It goes months go by, and I think, was that yesterday? But anyway,
yes.
I got this thing from Fox. Can you look over this trailer we're putting together for a new streaming service the show is going on to in Europe? And I'm like, okay, I'll do that. But I thought we were on Netflix in Europe. And he's like, what about, you know? And so that was just that made me suspicious. And sure enough, Hulu doesn't exist in Europe. So that what that meant was we were going onto Hulu in the U.S. and onto some other service.
And
so, but I have to put these things together. Or in an even worse example of this was our last year on the air on Fox. We were in our office, which was this office building in West Los Angeles. And we weren't told we were canceled, but one day a real estate agent came through the building showing our office space to a potential client. All right. That says, again, I'm putting the pieces together.
You can knock this wall down here, excuse
right.
me.
I don't immediately get the news, but there's hints.
I mean, you know, on the one hand, I think, well, it's not that different that, you know, like the networks now are like Hulu, Amazon, and Netflix. And just like in the old days, like, oh, some things are on CBS, some things are on NBC, some things are on ABC. But the difference is it was very rare that you would get used to seeing a show on NBC and then it would disappear. And you'd be like, where the fuck did that go? Oh, that's on ABC now.
Yeah. Except on the other hand, we were talking about this at work the other day, you know, shows we like. And we realized we were all talking about a show and then we realized none of us knew what service or channel it was on even.
Oh yeah.
So just like I see it, but it's just you don't think about it that way anymore. You know, it used to be like, oh, I'm turning to channel 4 on Thursday night. That's NBC, you know. But now you're just like people are more focused on the show than the venue.
Yeah, it doesn't people don't even really give a shit where they get their thing anymore.
The only annoying thing is that, you know, it seemed like things were simplifying where it's like, okay, I can download everything with my one Netflix subscription, but now you have to subscribe to 9 things again.
No, and I don't think it's ever going to get easier because just the more time that goes on, it just feels like the more proprietary, you know, every major corporation just says we want to own everything. And then the other one goes, well, no, we want to own everything. So there's never really going to be a standardized anything because everyone will think they should be the ones who owns it.
Yeah. I mean, the one thing you could imagine becoming kind of standardized is a per episode thing where they might come from all different services, but you wouldn't necessarily know if you had a central hub that could buy the episodes for $3.99 or
$2.99. Yeah. I mean, I tend to a
degree.
That's
what I end up doing a lot already
for
shows rather than figuring it's, you know, I pay my cable bill and then I go, I still don't feel like figuring out how to find it. Then I end up also buying it by the episode.
Oh, yeah. Our cable bill, we don't even, I mean, with the amount of money we spend on cable and how little we actually watch actual cable anymore. I mean, I can't even remember the last time.
My wife has a great
around.
Term for when you're flipping around and you actually end up watching something. She calls it a natural. So it's like, I caught a natural of Alien the other night. You know, or something.
That's really funny. It just happened to.
Right.
Could you fast forward? No, couldn't fast forward.
It's a natural. My daughter, and who's 10, has no concept of the TV where you can't fast forward or find the episode you want.
Oh, it must feel like a prison to her to think that
caveman TV.
There was a time where you had to just sit there and it would just hit you in the face at a certain time, and if you missed it, then you probably just didn't see it again for a long time. Was there ever There must have been talk. As I've said to you many times, Futurama is an unkillable show. It keeps coming back, and I believe that it's not done. I do believe Futurama will come back again, even after podcast and game form. But I'm sure there were conversations about taking it to Netflix or Hulu or something, about reviving it.
You know, we talk about it sometimes. My basic philosophy is, it's fairly complicated at this point because I've been through so many ups and downs with the show, you know, and so many last episodes ever that I've dealt with it many times.
Sure, sure.
In a way that's rare. You know, you don't get to have your show canceled 3 or 4 times normally, so it's really something to be either very proud or very ashamed of. I'm not sure. But, you know, the first 1 or 2 times the show got canceled, it was very emotional for me, and I had really sunk my every waking minute into it in the early years. And, you know, it unhealthily became my whole life in those days. So when it ended, it was like, you know, this is the end of an era and goodbye, everybody, and boo-hoo, and everyone's hugging each other. And, you know, we spend long hours sitting in, especially the writers, we spend many long hours in a small room locked together, kind of like your college roommates or something, you know, that you just end up talking about other stuff, and you know much too much about each other's lives and smells.
Of course.
So it felt, you know, it feels like, oh, goodbye this phase of my life. But then the show comes back, and a lot of those people are back. You know, oh, okay, we're back again. And then it's over, and it's, you know, okay, I guess I'll hug you again. But the third or fourth time, you can't break down, cry, and hug everybody anymore. It's just like, all right, you know, it was nice to be able to come back, and maybe it'll happen again, but you can't, the human body just can't have that degree of reaction.
Well, so you've been through it so many times, you're like, oh yeah, this.
Right. And
I'll
also,
see you next time.
And my record of predicting when the show will come back is zero. You know, it's always the opposite. When I say it's done, it's absolutely done, that's when the phone will ring and they're like, you know, there's, you know, Comedy Central is expressing interest, whatever it is. So I have no idea. The one thing I'll say at this point is, In the early days when we first went off Fox, I felt like the show was not complete and there were so much more to do. And there's always more to do, but I feel like at this point, having come back for movies and 4 more years in Comedy Central, that if we never did any more, I would still feel very satisfied and proud. So it doesn't have quite that feeling of there's a void that needs to be filled. But on the other hand, if the conditions were right, I'd be happy to do some more. But that we don't want to make the cheapo Futurama. You know, we don't want to back and go have everyone go, oh, it used to be good, but now it stinks. You know, it has to be, if someone wants to bring it back, it has to be done right with the cast and
like
the writers.
Like those super cheap animated versions of like Tom and Jerry that MGM did in the 60s. When they realized like, oh, we're going to make animation for television.
Right.
And, you know, we
don't even have to try.
Yeah, and then we'll just animate.
Because there's
like
only 3 channels.
And 12 frames per second.
Right.
And we'll just,
actually,
know.
12 frames per second is the is the standard, you know that.
I thought it was 24.
Well, there's 24 frames on TV. There's 24 frames
of
video per second.
But you shoot 2
they
per
call
12.
It, yeah, they call it animating
ones, twos,
on
threes.
Twos.
Yeah, that's right,
So for like Futurama, Simpsons, the standard is on twos. Now, when someone, you know, if Homer's doing a real... you guys see me acting this out with my hands here? When Homer's wiggling his fingers or, you know, conniving or something, they might animate that on the ones to really capture a real specific gesture or something. Or if we do 3D graphics in Futurama where a ship's flying on a real smooth arc,
right,
that'll be on the animated on the ones. But otherwise, on twos. But if you watch, I know you're talking about, if you go as far as like Japanese anime or something, I think some of that's on the fours or something.
There was a cartoon when I was growing up that was probably the worst animated from an animation standpoint, and I think it was called the Mighty Hercules. Do you remember the Mighty Hercules?
I remember the existence of a fictional character Hercules, I remember bad animation, so I can pretty much picture it.
There was a cartoon, and it was even beyond like all the Lou Scheimer stuff. The Lou Scheimer stuff I thought was pretty animated all right. It was like, oh, that was all the He-Man, you know, the He-Man cartoons. But this the Mighty Hercules, they would just like walk behind bushes so they wouldn't have to animate walks. You know, I took animation in college, and it was a path that if I hadn't – comedy was my first love, and if I hadn't been fortunate enough to – get some lucky breaks in that direction, I would have gone into animation because that's what I really...
What would have your specialty be? Let me rephrase it. What would your specialty have been?
I was trying... The job that I was trying to get was layout artist. Mm-hmm. And then...
So you have to... That means you can really draw.
Well, I thought I could really draw. But then I was... I became friends when I was in college just out of pure fandom. I kind of stalked Spumco and became friends with some of the directors at Spumco. So I was submitting to Ren and Stimpy, and I thought I was really good. But then when I saw like what really good artists are like, then I realized – I mean I never got – they never hired me, and rightfully so. But I realized like, oh, fuck. I'm not that good. Mm-hmm. I'm not –
That's kind of how I felt in graduate school studying computer science. I was like, I used to be pretty good, but now seeing all these – top students from around the world, I feel
yeah,
like.
Yeah, in your own little pond, you're great. Right. But then when you see all the best of the best, you're like, oh, I don't even rank.
I feel like I was, then you may feel the same way. I felt like I was good enough to appreciate how good the good people were. And that in itself is it's a luxury, or that's not the, I don't want to say blessing. That sounds like, because I'm not a religious
man.
Know what I mean. It's just, I feel honored to have been able to even appreciate how good the good people are.
Well, there are some things where you go, okay, yeah, I think I could – I think if I put in a lot of work, I could do that. But then sometimes you see a gap that's so great where you go, I'm not sure if I have enough lifetime to get – I think those people were just
– I think about that a lot when – because it's fairly common that someone – well, I'll be talking to someone who says, oh, me – you know, I or my cousin or somebody – really wants to get into voiceover and maybe, you know, what advice do you have or whatever. And – the thing I really want to say, but it's too demoralizing, is you don't know what you're up against, because the people I've gotten to work with, who many of whom you've had on your show 80 times, I know, but like Billy West and John DiMaggio and...
Yeah, and Rob Maurice, Paulson and Maurice
Tress
and...
McNeil. Rob Paulson we never had on.
You never had Paulson on Futurama?
I just met him the other day for the first time.
I just assumed because he's been in everything.
Yeah, no, I don't think we ever had him on, but he's buddies with Maurice, so I saw him at something the other day. But, you know... Really, what I want to say is if you think you're good at voiceover, remember that Billy West can sing in two voices at once in character, and he's singing. You know what I mean? Like, the things that these people can do are beyond belief. I mean, and not to mention they do impressions. So, you know, the only reason we can make these shows like Simpsons Futurama is that we have people who can do 20 completely distinct voices plus impressions and stuff. Otherwise, we'd have to pay hundreds of people because these, you know, these shows have a cast many times the size of the cast of a live action show.
I always love my favorite sort of voiceover. My favorite voiceover mechanism is the one where someone is in one character and doing a voice in that character's voice of another character.
Yeah.
So it's not just they're jumping and doing another character, it's what that character's impersonation of another character.
Yeah, we had an episode of Futurama where but I'm trying to remember what it was. I think you, the fans, will correct me, but I think Dr. Zoidberg was holding Hermes' limp dead body, temporarily dead, manipulating it like a puppet. And this is almost what I was just referring to, and singing a duet. It both as Zoidberg and as Zoidberg impersonating Hermes and singing. Like, who can do that, you know? But he can do it.
Yeah, and...
And at the end of the song, just as a joke, he's singing in harmony with himself. Although we did, I will admit we recorded that in two separate takes. It wasn't literally... He wasn't literally... But he can... But when I said he can make two notes at a time with his mouth, he can. You know,
yeah, that's incredible.
But he couldn't actually do two... voices in two different characters at the same time, although almost, I would say.
Yeah, I mean that's really in the kind of Mel Blanc. Voiceover, I think, is a great. I don't want to say unsung, but I just don't think, because so much of our culture is about like what you can see, and people think, oh, if I see someone and they're more famous, then that must mean they're better, you know, which is such bullshit. Because I think voiceover artists, it's one of the most incredible talents, like a really good voiceover artist, because they are conveying. There's such a concert between the voice that they create and then the artist, but the fact that they are able to create convey so many emotions and ideas and not be able to use their face in any way or anything physical, mm-hmm. but it's just sort of conveying all that through their voice. And of course, obviously, they come in and draw, and then they go back and do ADR and tweak and tweak and tweak. But I think, you know, some of the voiceover guys that I've, like the Maurices of the world that I've been lucky enough to work with, are truly some of the best performers in all of performing.
Yeah, one thing, another thing people forget when they're talking about doing voiceover is that it's acting.
And yeah.
acting itself, even acting in your own voice is very hard.
Yeah.
I found that out when I auditioned for the role of Bender.
You did?
Early on. Yes, I did. Because
you auditioned for yourself?
We had auditioned dozens of people, and it was very hard to cast the role of Bender, the robot, because it's so hard to break that idea in your mind that a robot sounds, I am a robot, you know, so it's hard to think back to the time when we didn't know what Bender would sound like. So we tried some people with robot voices, and then we're like, that's not going to hold, you know, we don't want to hear that every day for every week for years. So we tried, then we went, let's go with a really deep voice. So we had all these booming guys in there, and, you know, it just didn't look like him. And so at one point, Greg Daniels, who was the writer on The Simpsons and then later co-creator of King of the Hill and The Office and everything else, so that guy, but I knew him from The Simpsons, and he said, hey, Dave, you sound kind of like a robot. Why don't you audition for Bender? So,
thank you.
Yeah. It's like, oh, yeah. So,
What was your Bender voice? Was it just your voice?
It as me. So the idea was, you know, why don't you just try it as your voice? So I went and I auditioned for Matt Groening. But the thing was, this is kind of one of those moments when you again appreciate what other people do, not just the crazy voices, but the acting. And like the second I sat down and tried to read these lines, some of which I wrote, all I could think of were like how the other people had done the line, and I couldn't remember how I talk, you know? And
right.
So the second you're acting, it's hard. It's very, very, it's difficult. So I learned a big lesson, and I was not good at it, you know? I like to think maybe now, having observed these guys for so many years, I picked something up.
But that's what's so fun about the process of it is, you know, a really good production will find such a great relationship between. So DiMaggio comes in and he does. I'm this guy.
He auditioned for the professor with that voice, and then someone had the idea of bring him back in and have him do Bender in that voice, because we did have, you know, the character of Bender being this robot who drinks and parties it up and all. And so we're like, let's try that drunken sounding voice for Bender, and that was the key. But he had tried it as like an old crazy man, you know, crazy old man voice first.
But so he comes in and does that, and then you guys, it's sort of like shopping for a Christmas present, I guess, mm-hmm. where you go, oh, no, that's the thing. Mm-hmm. I can't tell you exactly what I'm looking for, but when I see it, I'll know it.
Yeah. Some people, and so that part was very hard to cast, although I think in the end it paid off handsomely with one of the, you know, most memorable voices. But, and other ones were very easy to cast, and I'll go back to Dr. Zoidberg, where Billy West was the first person to come in. He did Dr. Zoidberg he had the part within 3 seconds. Because, again, we didn't know what Dr. Zoidberg would sound like.
But you gave him the character sheet.
We gave him the picture and some lines to read. But, you know, and the name Zoidberg, and that's what he went from. So,
but so when they come in and they bring something that you like, a voice that makes sense to you, and then as a series develops, it's like the voice informs the writing a little bit, and then the writing reinforms the voice, and the voice reinforms the writing a little bit to really build this,
yeah.
this, you know, solid, perfect character.
Yeah, it's a long feedback loop, because it takes us almost a year to make these episodes. So to, you know, see what really worked, or at least how it all worked together, it's a year from when you first started on it, and then it's another year before you could implement any lessons you learn from that. So you will notice in Futurama, and even more so in The Simpsons, the voices, for example, change from what they start at the very beginning. Then they lock into something, but there's that feedback loop that takes about the first 2 seasons to see, oh, that's what's really working. And the writers are, like you say, it's a convergence where the writers are working toward the voice and the voice is working toward the lines, and it gets to something that sticks.
Well, especially with animation, because it just takes so long. So you can do a whole season of something, and then you have no idea if any of it worked until it's done and
you
see it.
We're not saying making a conscious choice, like, you know, make the professor's voice a little gravelly or less, whatever it is. We're not – that never happens. It's just – it's an evolution where you, on an episode-to-episode basis, we don't even notice it when we're doing it, but it just – it slowly locks in to its spot without conscious.
Were you on The effort. Simpsons since season one?
No, not at all. I came in the beginning of season five. I helped out a little bit with a couple of the very last stages of some season four episodes.
Got it. Because that is a – I mean, Homer was 100% just a different character.
Yeah, Walter Matthau. It was a Walter Matthau impression.
Right. Oh, I didn't realize that's what that was.
Yeah.
That was the Frosty Chocolate Milkshakes
yes,
guy.
Yes, that's exactly it.
And then it's funny to me that just one season it was like, well, he's not none of that anymore. And then the animation changed and everything. Mm-hmm. Do they ever? I guess at that point, you know, in an era pre social media where everyone felt like they need everything explained to them, they were just like, ah, fuck it, the audience will be fine. They'll figure it out.
Yeah, but again, I think you're giving too much credit to the intentions of the writers and producers. Like, I think it was more like, you know, Dan tried something, he got a little bigger laugh at the table, or it sounded better to him, and it just moved that way. But I don't, you'll have to get him on. Have you had him on?
I don't think I've had Dan on before.
You gotta have him on.
Yeah, we gotta have Dan on. We've never had Dan on before.
He's hilarious. But I think it was, yeah, it was, I think it's more of always more of an evolution than a
oh season five decision. Was a that was a sweet time to be at this that was I mean that is a golden era. Season four, I mean, I, you know, I watch every season of The Simpsons, but I think that kind of like season four to season nine, season ten,
that's exactly when I was there, so nice. You're really buttering me up
nice right. Yeah, I mean, you had the, you know, the fighting hellfish is probably
you can't
one of
name
my,
one episode. Can
the Abe Simpson the fighting hellfish episode?
Right. Mr. Burns is 300 years old, fighting in World War One. I think he may have fought in the Spanish American War.
But what was? Because now you've been through this experience a couple times with shows where you get so many seasons under your belt. And are you're just staring around, the writers are going, what are we going to talk about now that we have never talked about before? How are we going to do this?
You know, one of the nice things about Futurama getting canceled every few years is that the world would generate some new material for us. So
right.
Some easy examples being, for example, when we came back on Comedy Central, well, the iPhone had been invented since we went off of Fox. So, all right, we'll do an episode with the iPhone, EYE,
right.
iPhone, for any lawyers listening to this, and about, you know, social media, and, you know, Fry posts something about Leela with his iPhone, some embarrassing video. But that story didn't exist the first time around. Or, you know, there was this Proposition 8 in California to legalize gay marriage right around that time. So we said, okay, we'll do our Proposition Infinity episode to legalize robosexual
yes.
marriage between a human and a robot. So the world generates ideas which we can make our 1,000 years in the future version of. So that's a nice thing about getting canceled.
And also and you have that safe cushion of satire where – we're like, oh, it's 1,000 years in the future, and it's animated,
right.
So you really can go hard after stuff and still get away with it. There were some seasons of The Simpsons where it just got so a little too on the nose with some political commentary.
Even in your golden era, we did a couple more with contemporary politicians. Like I did a Halloween episode with Bill Clinton and Bob Dole.
Oh, yeah, where they get...
And then there was the episode where George Bush moved to Springfield. But you have to remember that in those earlier seasons, if it's like season six or seven of a show, this I'm not joking around when I say this, you think there's 1 or 2 years left in this show probably. So you don't have this idea in your mind, oh, this reference is going to be 20 years old and the show is still going to be airing every day, five times a day, you know? So there we just weren't thinking about it in those terms that kids will be born and grow up and die and
That was a classic Treehouse of Horror where they decide to put aside their differences and they just get launched into space.
And then
Kang and Kodos?
What was the line? Don't blame me, I voted for Kodos. Or,
oh, yeah. But, when they've all been enslaved, the human race has been enslaved.
Right.
Yeah. That was I didn't realize that was yours. How did the stories break on The Simpsons? Were you assigned an episode? Was every writer assigned an episode, and then you came in and workshopped it? Or
yeah, basically, there's two ways it could go, basically. Either usually a couple times a year we'll get together on The Simpsons. This is The Simpsons specifically I'm talking about. We have a story retreat where everybody will get together for a whole day, a whole excruciating day, and we'll go around the room and everybody will present a fairly detailed pitch for a possible story we could do, and we talk about it for a while, and then whoever's running the show, possibly in conjunction with Matt Groening and James L. Brooks, will decide which seem the most promising, and those will go ahead. And sometimes there's ideas that are just floating around, or someone has an idea that they don't have time to write or whatever, and that will get assigned to somebody. So sometimes you write a story that's your own idea. Sometimes you get a story assigned to you. But, you know, roughly speaking, they kind of go around and try to spread them out so the people on staff each get one a year or something like that.
Do you have a favorite of yours?
Or mine?
Yeah.
For The Simpsons?
Yeah.
I kind of like the – I go back and forth. I kind of like the Itchy and Scratchy and Poochie show.
That's a fucking classic.
It was a commentary on – a show being on a long time, although it was still only in season 8 or something like that. But it's self-referential in a way that I think got away with it without, you know, bugging people
too
much.
Well, because it was about a greater idea about marketing people getting in the way and jumping – and, like, not just jumping the shark but, like, throwing the show over the shark.
And also in the sense that it was about the fans' interaction with the show, which was a novel – more novel thing than – because we were just starting to read the internet – discussions of, you know, alt.tv.simpsons at that time about the show, and so there's references to that. So I feel like it was one of the earlier attempts to deal with, you know, how do you please people on the internet who are all, call everything the worst episode ever and that kind of stuff. So,
but the idea when they're trying to, I mean, focus grouping is useless, I think, is not you pull like 10 people in a mall and stick them in a room and go find something wrong with this, right? Like, well, they're gonna find, but just this idea where he's saying you want them to have more grounded adventures but you want them to have more fantastic. What do you want? I don't know what you want.
Yeah, I have a theory that I believe that most people who watch TV, including intelligent people who, you know, are smart people, they know perfectly well what they like and what they didn't like on TV, but they don't know why. You know, a few people do, but if you were to say that was a bad episode, the reason people give from the inside and having seen how the script was written, or often say feel like they've given the reason, which is the wrong reason. Like they'll say that episode was, I was on the floor the whole time, but I'm thinking, no, that episode had a real strong emotional story in it that just got you more hooked into it, and the jokes were about the same as ever.
Right.
You know what I mean? So I feel like there's different things about it, or there's, you know, there's a character that just had, it was grating on people or whatever it is, but there's reasons they didn't like it, which they may find hard to identify and just end up saying it was stupid, or it wasn't funny, or it was less funny, or it didn't make sense. That's it. But I don't think people can put their finger on it.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, because
we often can't ourselves either, I should say, as the writers. But that's the challenge, you know. If we can find that recipe that makes it good, then it's going to be good. But
well, I think so many things in the human brain have to sort of align to connect with something. And yeah, sure, sometimes it's more obvious. So I really like, you know, dogs make me sad. So the Futurama dog episode is the saddest episode. You know, like people can say that, but in general.
In that episode, there's not a lot of doubt. It's like a dog died, and it's very sad. Everybody's agreed on that one. But
I've only
they're not agreed on whether they like it or not.
Ever been able to watch that one once.
It's pretty harsh.
It's one of those. Yeah, I mean, it's a beautiful episode, but that's one that I can't. That it just, like, why do I need to emotionally cut myself today? You know, I mean, when
it's not my, you know. I'm proud of it in the sense that I think it's a good story and it's touching and all, but it's not that's not the noblest way to get a tear out of someone's eye, in the sense that there's episodes where you're touched in a more human way about relationships, or somebody who, you know, you're heartbroken or whatever it is, where it's like, if you can get a tear from that story, your writing was a little more precise and
right.
successful. Whereas getting it from the dog dying, yes, it everybody's going to cry. At that,
you know what, though? I do you say that, but it's still a nice story,
though.
Oh, it
is.
Like,
it's
not just, hey, this dog died. Wah, you know, like, no. It's really a beautiful story.
Right, but but the whole episode, you don't feel, you're not on the verge of, you're not that emotionally on edge that whole episode. It's actually a pretty funny, that's the thing with that episode. That episode is pretty goofy along the way, this back and forth and Fry's, you know, dancing the hustle in the rain in New York in a flashback, and there's a lot of pretty silly stuff happening. So the rug is just then ripped out from under you at the end, because you didn't know it was going to be that kind of episode, you know?
Right.
So again, that made it all the more shocking and caused an involuntary tear duct compression at the end.
Do you have a particularly favorite type of episode? Do you like ones that are more sciencey and mathy, or do you like ones that are goofier, or do you just like the balance?
I think the balance. I know that's maybe a boring answer, but you know, we do a lot of work to try to mix it up during the season and make sure we have a variety of types of episodes, including maybe one or two of those real emotional ones, and you know, maybe one that has a musical in it, and one that's got some experimental animation where we try animating in black and white or 8-bit graphic style, or you know, those right. kind of experiments, and give all the characters their story and work a couple side characters in so we learn more about them. So that's kind of the bigger picture challenge, even on a show that doesn't have a lot of continuity, is can we hit all these goals in right. one season?
Yeah. I mean, when you made the transition to Future, was it the did Matt come to you and say, hey, I'm going to do this Future show for another animated show for Fox. Can I pull you off The Simpsons and have you show run it? Was it that simple?
Yeah, it wasn't that quick, though. It was, Matt came into the room and looked around and said, who's that nerdy guy with glasses over there? And then everybody in the room raised their hands. Pretty accurate description of everybody.
No, but, the one who sounds like a
right,
robot.
Yeah, exactly. So, no, but yeah, that to be singled out as a nerd in the Simpsons writing room is really saying something. So, but I was somehow.
Well, I know why though, because yeah. when we did that live episode at the Avalon. And I said, did you bring in, you know, mathematicians and scientists? And you go, we were the mathematicians and the scientists.
Oh, I owe you an apology, by the way.
What?
For that exact thing, because you had obviously done your research, and you asked me a nice question in front of hundreds of thousands of viewers on the internet. Like, you guys had experts, you know, weigh in on these math and science stuff, right? And I got offended, as you just said. Absolutely not. Where, you know, I got a master's degree, and we had three PhDs in the show, and but later I realized, no, we didn't have paid professional consultants, but I did turn to some of my buddies from the old days who had actually gotten their degrees in math and science, and no doubt you had seen me talk about that in the past. So yes, mainly my friend David Sheminovich, who I'll credit, who's an astrophysicist at Columbia, and sometimes, you know, we'd have an idea. We want the ship to go faster than the speed of light, and we want to acknowledge that that's stupid and impossible, but in a way that, you know, will please people rather than infuriating them. So that, for example, early in the show, I talked to him about it, and I settled on the idea that, okay, they don't go faster than the speed of light. In the future, they have sped up the speed of light, so they still have to go. But so
they're still behind.
But also, you know, he also provided a bunch of those equations about the mass of the Higgs particle, which has right. subsequently been found to be only off by a factor of, I don't know, 2 or 5 or something from what he predicted. So that's pretty good. So, yeah, so he is my number one consultant, but, you know, a few other people from the old days. Was that what I was supposed to be answering? Or?
No, yeah. Because it really is, you know, part of what I think makes anything, particularly an animated show, really magical is just the depth of detail. And, like, for instance, like we talked about at The Thing, the alien language and how people cracked it right away, and then you had to
with a much harder one.
Yeah, so just for – I'm sure – you know, I just for any people listening who are not hardcore Futurama fans, there are these – essentially like these glyphs that appear in several parts of a lot of the episodes.
And background signs, billboards and
right.
things in the future New York City.
And it's actually a language. I mean there's –
there's two of them. Yeah, there's one we put in – starting right in the pilot, that's just what they call a simple substitution code, where each letter of our alphabet, A, B, C, D, E, F, has a symbol, a crazy alien symbol associated with it. So we had a billboard in that show that said Drink Slurm, S-L-U-R-M, which is this futuristic addictive soft drink we have in the show.
Spit out by a giant slug.
Yeah, exactly. Not spit out, but excreted from the opposite end.
But the other end, yeah, spit out in that way.
Go into any more details. And then we had the same billboard in a different part of the show, but the word drink, just those letters, D-R-I-N-K, only those five letters were shown as the five alien symbols. So you had those five to work with. And then elsewhere in the pilot episode, we put other signs in the background only in this alien language. And then that's a standard type of cryptography problem where it's like, okay, we know how common letters are. There's probably some I's here and there, and we know what the I looks like. So we're like, how long is it going to take people to decode all these other signs we put in the background? You know, a week, a month, a year, will they even notice? So check the internet and, you know, an hour after the show. Here's all the signs. So that's when we said, okay, we're gonna try something more difficult. So we had a writer, Jeff Westbrook, on the show who had previously been a professor of computer science. So we assigned him the task of designing a more cryptographically secure code. And it was not what you would use to encode your credit card transactions, but it was a lot harder and required us to even use a computer program to translate from English into this second alien language. So that one took a few days, probably. And then the really irritating thing for that one was that we made a mistake encoding one thing. So there was just, you couldn't decode the sign.
Oh, shit.
It went on the air with a mistake. So people were not that happy about that.
And you're like, you know, there's a whole other show that the show is actually not
right,
the language.
Right.
We were
a little busy at the time. And
did you ever retcon that? Did you ever go back in?
I don't think we did. I feel guilty. I don't remember. I should look that up and
see if you ever corrected it.
We can fix it. And the next time there's a change of medium, you know, whatever comes after streaming, when they start beaming it straight into our sinuses or whatever.
Yeah, that's exactly right. When we just have the experience or the memory of having seen it, but we didn't actually see it.
In the back of your eyes from your sinuses.
Was there anything that no one picked up on? Were there any Easter eggs that got by everyone?
Probably, but now I don't remember. Boy, I'm going to break the most boring secret in history here. This is of no interest whatsoever. Can I set the bar any lower?
Please.
But on one of the DVDs, this one no one noticed because it's so boring and stupid. On one of the DVDs, we put in this 22-minute episode of the Everyone Loves Hypnotoad show, which is, for the most part, our character of Hypnotoad, a googly-eyed toad making a loud buzzing sound for 22 straight minutes and hypnotizing the audience. That's the joke of his popular show in the future. But it does – the 22-minute thing we did has about 2 minutes of commercial breaks here and there that are actually – that's where the actual entertainment – so I've described this thing as it's 2 minutes of entertainment packed into a 22-minute episode.
That's fantastic.
So, but somewhere in his googly eye at some point we put a little – we faded in and out a little ad for one of our Futurama products like Bachelor Chow cereal or something like that.
Oh, that's great.
So keep an eye on that next time you watch it.
Well, I thought you guys did a great job of because in the double podcast episode, and
yes,
by double, I just...
Shouldn't we be talking about that? Was that... Now, this is the magic of recording technology.
That's already gone up by the
that's
time
been
this
on,
goes up.
Yeah, okay, so you're hearing me and everyone's... Billions of people around the world have already heard that podcast.
I thought it would make more sense to put this up after people had heard that, so we weren't talking about something they hadn't heard yet.
I can give minor spoilers if we're talking about it.
I won't give anything. So here's
huge
the away. Here are the yeah. There is a minor spoiler warning if you have not listened to Radiorama yet, but it's 42 minutes, which is a double length of an episode. It's not two episodes; it's just the double length of an episode.
Right. It's an epic. 43 minutes.
43 minutes. 43 minutes.
Tell a nerd that his show's 1/43rd shorter than it actually is.
But it was such a great. I mean, this. You know, the way that, and I explained it in the intro of the that episode, but the game Futurama Worlds of Tomorrow being able to sort of piggyback off that as a promotional item because when you make stuff, someone's got to pay for it, you know, like someone's got
to
pay for it.
Right. You wanted me to tell the story a little bit of how we – did you tell it already in the intro to that thing?
I told my point of view, but I don't have any of your behind-the-scenes information. So
I mean, basically, there is this game was in development, as you said, called Futurama Worlds of Tomorrow, mobile game. And the company making it is this company called Tiny Co. that while we were making it got bought out by another company called Jam City. But they were very good about saying, we want this to have the real flavor of Futurama. We want to get the whole cast involved. We want to get the real original writers involved. We want to get the real original animators involved, which they did. And then they said, well, we want to get the word out to the fans that they're, you know, we really have put the team back together for this, and you're going to get some real Futurama DNA. What's the best way? Well, can we do a new episode of the show? And I said, I doubt it. You know, it's very expensive and it takes a very long time. And then someone said, like, well, what if we don't animate it and we just make it like a radio episode? And then suddenly an alarm bell went off in my head because I had talked to you,
yes,
Chris Hardwick, about that very idea maybe a year earlier. And you had asked me and Matt if we were, you know, we would ever consider that. And as I said, being a fan of old-time radio and just trying things new, I thought, you know, it sounds good, but yes, somebody has to still, even for that, someone's got to pay for it. And it sounds easy, but it's not that easy because we have to write a giant script and
right.
record. And so anyway, the game company suggested it, and I said, well, maybe things are going to come together here. I had them talk to you, and I don't know what you said, but it seemed to work. And I gave them like five warnings still. I said, you know, this is going to be almost as much work as doing a real episode. It's just going to be faster, you know.
Right.
But it's going to be a lot of work, especially if you want us to make it longer than a regular episode. So they said, we want to do it. We want to do it. So, all right, I warned you. And so I got together two of the old writers, longtime writers, Patrick Verone and Ken Keeler. And then so the three of us wrote the script. We were shooting for 30 minutes, which was the original goal. But I will say, it sort of turned into a labor of love because we hadn't done this for a while. And we're like, well, we want to give everyone a story. And Bender's got to have a story. And Fry and Leela. And there's got to be a horrible monster played by Chris Hardwick threatening the world. And so, you know, we wanted to get everything in there while we're doing this because, you know, you can get another chance or not. So it ended up being two episodes long instead of 1.5 episodes long. But we just, you know, we wanted to do it justice. So
yeah, I mean, I remember when I was having conversations with them about how long they thought, how long should it? They said, well, how long should it be? And yeah. they said, you know, should they be like 15 minutes or 20 minutes? And I said, well, you know, if it's not going to be, is it, you know, at least a half hour is a good length, because anything shorter than that doesn't feel like,
right,
you know, it just doesn't feel substantial.
It's like, less substantial than a regular episode.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
you want,
yeah.
If it's a special event, you want it to be at least as substantial as
you don't want it to
Joe
just,
Blow episode.
Yeah, and you don't want it to just sound like a commercial,
right.
You know?
And it very much doesn't sound like a commercial,
no.
If you've heard it. I mean, they gave us free rein. We wrote this big, crazy, I think it came out pretty good.
It was
story.
So much fun.
And we worked way too hard on it. I mean, you know, it was, as I said, we just got sucked into it. But then the entire original cast is in there, and spent a couple long days recording it and did it right. So it's all there. It's a pretty big production as audio things.
But even the commercials for the game, it was so brilliantly done that you made it okay to talk about the game by going to commercial breaks where you had goofy.
Right. All the commercials. There's other commercials that are just fake,
yes.
Total goof-offs. And then there's a few for the game that are also bordering on being total goof-offs. But again, they let us get away with it because they want it to be in the tone of the show. So yeah, it's a pretty not on the nose as far as promotion goes. You know, it's 99% entertainment.
But also perfectly on – it's like it's so on point for what an old-timey radio show would have been. So it could completely works out. It totally works
it
out.
It kind of reminds you of why it used to be like, you know, the – Brillo soap hour or whatever,
yes.
It was, but yeah, it's like, oh, you, yeah, it was. They were a little more upfront about the entertainment was there to serve the purpose of that. Someone's paying for it.
Yeah.
Now they try to disguise that a little more, but not us.
That was so much fun. That was such a great. I mean, just never thinking that I would ever get to, you know, ever get to.
Boy, and you were good, by the way.
Oh, thanks.
Speaking of how I wasn't that good when I tried to do it. I mean, you. For anyone who hasn't heard it yet, Chris plays the part of this, I'm not going to give away too much, but this alien who evolved over hundreds and thousands of years from all of the billions of unheard podcasts out there in the universe. There were so many that they evolved into a life form that became angry and came back to get us. But we did this voice to kind of represent that idea of what this creature was, where Chris did multiple takes of every line in different voices, and so he speaks in this kind of chorus, every one of which is Chris's, a real voice Chris is doing. It's not an electronic, when you hear it, it's not electronic processing, but it's...
That was so much fun.
It's pretty cuckoo, and... You know, thank God we have this great editor, Paul Calder, again, our original editor on the show, and I roped him into doing it in his spare time. But, you know, someone else might have said, you're going to have to pay me four times if we're going to edit four voices together. But he said, I will take this as a challenge.
I can do this.
Got all four takes in there.
I can do that. Yeah, that was when I came home that night, you know, because my wife is also an enormous Futurama fan. She was like, how was it? I was like, it was so much fun. Like, I could totally shred it, but it was so worth it. It was so worth it.
Oh, were you hoarse when you came back?
I was hoarse when I came back, but it was so worth it because one of the voices was really booming, but one of the voices was really soft, and one was really screechy. Right.
Again, I don't want to keep harping on this since it's not even my field specifically, but about the challenge of being a voice actor, those people can scream all day. And then do it again the next day. And sometimes when I'm editing the show, if we couldn't get one of the actors in there, or I decide to change a line after the fact, knowing I'll re-record it later, whatever, I will have to temp the line in there. So to do one temp line as Bender or one of these loudmouth characters, you have to scream. A regular line for Bender is a screaming line for a normal human being, you know.
Yeah.
And I'll be hoarse after a few takes of one line, and so I saw you performing for 2 hours and not getting hoarse until you just admitted that you were.
I did. I was
very impressed. But you're a person who talks a lot for a living. But these guys sometimes they record like a video game where they have to scream, you know, death cries for hours at a time. And it's just brutal. And apparently there's some muscles you can build up or something. But that is hard to do.
I mean, DiMaggio is like a rock star. I mean, like legitimately rock star.
Yeah.
Because it's just that. You know, doing that voice after, because he does a lot of loud characters.
Yeah.
And it's sort of like how you see someone who's on tour and like, oh, you do 200 shows a year and you're screeching the whole time. They just sort of figure it out. But I did voices at Nickelodeon for like 12 years and I always managed to pick loud voices and regret it. Now, like the very first one that I ever did was a really loud, screechy version of Wallace Shawn.
Mm-hmm.
And it went great in the audition. I thought it was really funny until like episode 4 when I realized like, oh, I just
dug
my
own
back. It's my fault, you know, like, because there, when you do that, inevitably it's always like more, louder.
Right.
and then
now he's angry. Yeah. Like, wait a second. He was, you know.
He was screeching when he was happy, though.
Right. You know, John DiMaggio is the real life Bender. And he is so loud in real life that once I was literally at a concert once, and it was, you know, a deafening concert with crowd of deafening people indoor. This is at the Troubadour or someplace that was, you know, reasonably sizable place. And then I'm sitting there like, John DiMaggio's here. Because you could hear him over a rock band and 300, you know, 500 loud people. Just anywhere you are, you know. If you're within 100 yards of him, you know it.
Oh, yeah. And he's – did you guys – I'm assuming because of the way that we record a Radiorama that you record everyone individually?
You
used to record as a group?
Normally when with shows in production, we would record
That's
as a group
best.
To the degree possible. You know, often you can't get somebody, but we try to schedule people so that when they have scenes together, they record together.
Oh,
so
that's great.
What so you saw was actually not the normal thing, yeah. And so especially for those emotional scenes where, you know, if it's like Fry and Leela having a heart-to-heart discussion after, you know, they've gone through time and spent their lives together or whatever that week's thing is. And it gets, especially when it gets kind of quiet, kind of the opposite of what we're talking about, it is very helpful to have them in the same room because they have to be at the same level of emotion
right.
in the conversation. And so the directing becomes much harder if they're not there. You're like, I'm trying to remember what Billy sounded like, and I'm like,
well,
okay,
normally
Katie Sagal, take it down a notch, or you do ADR later, you redo it all again.
Oh, this
later.
Is what they sounded like.
Right.
Oh, okay, I guess try to
right.
match that.
But everything's better if you get it the first time because then the animators can animate to the voice track, and their visuals will match the vocal acting. You know, so if the animators are guessing what the tone's supposed to be, and you do it later, it's never going to be quite as good.
Was the plan always to get Fry and Leela together, or did that just evolve throughout the course?
It started out as, well, you know, Fry is a dum dum who's got a crush on Leela, who's out of his league,
right?
But also has her problems because she's a one-eyed oddball herself. We didn't plan out years in advance. Is he going to win her over or not? But that seemed like a nice way to go to have. So what turned out to be a nice way to go is to have Fry up his game a little bit and actually become a little more competent and try, even if he was naturally a bumbling idiot, that in a given episode he could actually, if his heart was in it, he could become better at something and actually impress her,
right?
And become, you know, make himself a little smarter because he had such a lofty goal of winning her over. So that was more fun than just either having him fail completely or having her for no reason fall for his stupidity. So
he really was a product, though, of like he was. It's kind of, I guess I'm just thinking about this now, but he was a product of the 90s, that sort of, you know, the slacker generation.
Yeah,
he was just sort of the standard, like, you know, didn't really have aspirations, like, kind of maybe had aspirations,
right,
but not really.
Young people now like to care about things, but not back then.
They care the fuck out of things now, but back then it was like, I don't know, whatever.
I got a nice sofa and a TV.
I mean, do you think you do you think you did everything that you wanted to do with the show? If you never did it again, would you feel like, yeah, we did it? We accomplished what we wanted to
do. Yeah, I mean, I think that's basically what I was saying earlier, unless you re-edit this interview into a different order, but just that I feel it's a complete body of work kind of at this point. But I don't feel we did everything. Let me answer this in two parts. I feel very satisfied, and I feel it does stand. I think it's 140 episodes counting those movies. So, you know, if you weren't comparing it to The Simpsons or maybe Family Guy, you'd be like, that's a good long run for a show. You wouldn't expect more than that, right? It's only in the age of The Simpsons on episode 632 or whatever. I don't know. I made that up. It's in the 600s. That you go like, oh, you could have gone so much longer. So yes, we could. There's an infinite supply of stories about those characters or about that are science fiction stories. You know, it's not going to run out. And so in my mind, the way I always think of it is that those characters are still out there doing their thing. We're just not writing it down right now. But, you know, I believe, you know, we always try to leave it in a stage where there's some hope for the future, and we could come back, but if we don't come back, you, at least as a viewer, can imagine those characters are going on and having adventures.
Do you have a Good News Everyone favorite?
A favorite version of Good News Everyone?
Do you have a favorite Good News joke?
Once we did News Everyone, kind of, speaking of neutral, having no particular opinion, but yeah, there's not many variants on it that we didn't do, probably.
I loved Good News Everyone, Bad News.
Yeah. It's funny, like that was not intended at the beginning to be his catchphrase. It was just, you know, we just wrote it in an early episode and, hey, that sounded pretty good, and it's really widely useful because it's equally good when he has bad news to deliver, you know. It still works, so it's good to work in a catchphrase pretty early because it saves few minutes of a few brain cells now and then to be able to fall back on that.
Definitively say how old Farnsworth is?
We did, because there's an episode where he gets younger. But not that one. Well, we may have also given away his age in that one, but in an earlier one, he goes to this forced retirement home called the Near Death Star, which is this orbiting. It's basically the Matrix orbiting the Earth, where old people are forcibly retired and get plugged into this, you know, matrix retirement colony. So you're supposed to go. We reveal on that episode that you're supposed to go when you're 150, and the professor has been faking it, and he's really already turning 100. No, I take it back. Before you fans can correct me, the professor's having a 150th birthday party, and I think he's really 160. He's been faking it, and that's when forced retirement is 160. And so the secret gets out, and they forcibly drag him off to this thing, and then they have to rescue him. And then they do rescue him, and then we don't really deal with why he isn't dragged back there again. But there was, as you said, another episode where he got younger, so maybe part of that stuck a little. Actually, I was going to say part of that stuck, and he was younger, but now that I'm remembering that episode, we actually say he got a little bit older at the end. So.
Well, because I remember having when the last run of Black Mirror episodes came out, and then there was an episode where...
Oh, I haven't seen all of them yet, so no spoiler. Yeah, just give me the premise. I love the original Black Mirror, and I've still only seen one or two of the...
Well, there's one. It's okay. That premise where people in a retirement community are hooked into...
they ripped us off.
I mean, when I saw that episode again after having seen that Black Mirror episode, I was like, wait a minute, this is a Futurama episode. Yeah. I mean, it's not this where they went with it is completely different
But I'll watch it then.
But the idea of essentially, putting your consciousness into a cloud or some type of a computing construct was a Futurama episode first. It was kind of interesting. But when you started Futurama, were there things that you consciously did to say like, well, you know, the art style is similar, but we have to make sure that this is not The Simpsons? Like,
very much. That was a big concern of Matt Groening because he could have easily been accused of ripping off The Simpsons and making, second-rate Simpsons or whatever. He didn't want to have to deal with that. You don't want to have to compare your show to what was at the time, the greatest show in the history of the world. And
right.
Probably is. And was also, one of the top-rated shows. And so you want to try to make it different. At the same time, and I'm sure Matt will forgive me for saying this, he has a somewhat of a limited palette as far as his drawing style goes. If it's going to be a real Matt Groening thing, it's going to have those characters with the big eyes and the overbite. So it's going to be in that style. So we have to look for other ways to distinguish it because it wasn't going to be in the character design. So number one, the Simpsons about parents and kids, basically. So we said, let's avoid that. Let's make this about young adults who are getting a job and working together and hanging out together. So it's immediately like a different demographic and might have more romance stories and that kind of thing. And, hanging around the office stories. So just the type of characters we had, first of all. Number two, obviously the setting in this crazy futuristic setting that would not be mistaken for Springfield. And I want it to be three things because that's the normal amount in a list. But those are the two. Really, it was those two things.
Well, because it's really hard to the last time I saw Matt at Futurama, and again, he's just could not be nicer every time I see him.
That is true, by the way. I want to come out and say that Matt Groening, who's given me basically my whole career, and so thank you. But what a nice down to earth guy for one of the most successful people in the world. I mean. Couldn't be a more nice, regular guy.
Well, I tried not to spew fandom at him, which is because I know everyone. I mean, I'm sure literally every person he encounters that finds out that knows who he
especially
is.
Especially at Comic-Con, though. If you run into him at Comic-Con, then then he's the Beatles at Comic-Con. I've literally seen like hordes of teenagers screaming as he walks by and stuff.
Of course.
It's really funny.
But when I was growing up, my mom and my stepdad, we lived in Colorado for a brief period of time in the late 80s. And in a pre-internet era, it was really – you really had to hunt and gather the types of nerdy pop culture stuff that you wanted. It was not easy to come by because it wasn't just – you couldn't just access it whenever you wanted. Or find a community who would go, hey, here, I'll email you this. And there was the alternative newspaper, there was, I think it was called Westward. And that's where I discovered Life in Hell. And it just, that changed it just broadened my comedy horizons for what something could be. But it was, there were just a few comic strips in this, alternative. It was like, sort of like the LA Weekly, but even a little cooler and a little more alternative than that. Uh-huh. And Life and all the Life in Hell books and all of the, I'm sure people say like, why wasn't Bongo an animated show or why was, some of those characters in early Simpsons make a little, there's little Easter eggs here and there.
Yeah, I mean, to some degree, I think we tried to sneak in a Bongo here and there and, Akbar or whoever, but we did, I think, little references occasionally with an alien or something, but I think he does want to – that's its own thing, And, he doesn't want to steal from himself as much as he doesn't want to steal from somebody else. And
sure.
Maybe there'll be an animated Life in Hell someday. I don't know. Anything could happen, but I think he doesn't want to mix his metaphors too
much. Gotcha. But I always loved that Akbar and Jeff every so often would have a new business that they were trying to promote, and the entire strip was just them all about their business, or even just in nine panels, eight panels of them just looking at each other, and then the ninth panel, then they finally say something. I mean, it was such an interesting way to tell a story.
Sometimes when we were working on Futurama, Matt would, I forget which day of the week it was, but he had to have his strip in that, you know, he had to get it into FedEx to ship it off that night at that time. And I would just see him sitting at his desk with 16 squares in front of him, and, you know, and his, oh God. So you could tell it had, you know, he would always wait till the last day. And then that's that day, you know, he'd be, he was really, he was dedicated to it, but it was a lot of work to do that and try to keep two shows on the air.
Were you a big animation fan before, or was it just...
It was chance, pretty much, that my whole career has ended up animation. I watched plenty of TV when I was a kid, but no more or less animation than anyone else in the early 80s, late 70s, whenever I was plastered to the TV. But my very first writing job when I was taking a leave from graduate school and seeing if I could do it was, I won't go into all the details unless you want me to blow 15 more minutes, but through a series of very lucky circumstances, I got hired to write one of the first episodes of Beavis and Butthead.
What?
By Mike Judge, who I had never met. I had never even met him, but I had sent some stuff to David Letterman, who didn't hire me, but like somebody there who I didn't know handed my stuff to Mike Judge, who was looking for the cheapest writers available. And someone said, oh, I like this stuff, was good, although we didn't hire him. And so that's the story in 1 minute. But so Mike Judge called me up and said, I saw your stuff that I hadn't sent to him. And do you want to submit some ideas? So then I wrote a couple of those very first episodes of Beavis and Butthead when it went on MTV as a series. He had done... You know, one or what he had done that one, Frog
Which
Baseball.
Episode? Yeah, Frog Baseball.
I wrote one called Couch Fishing, where they're sitting on a couch, throwing a hook out the window and seeing what they can reel in from their couch. And I wrote one called Plate Frisbee, where they're at their, what was their friend's name? They had a friend who they were always just torturing. I can't remember his name even. It's been a while. But they took a very expensive china plate from his house and played frisbee with it. It was called Plate Frisbee.
Yeah, that was right after the when he used to do the Spike and Mike festivals, and there was Frog Baseball, right. And there was the other one where they were with the monster truck pull.
And so, yeah, and so I had only seen, I think there were only two in existence at the time he hired me, and so I watched Frog Baseball, and they're hitting a frog with a bat, and yeah. The one thing I know is it has to involve animal cruelty. So like in that plate, when they throw a plate and the dog tries to catch it and it jumps up and catches this china plate in his teeth and all his teeth shatter. And so some people are upset about it, but I thought I had to do that. But anyway, the gist of it being that this show came out of nowhere and then was a success. And so I accidentally sort of had a calling card as an animation writer. And then I got hired on The Simpsons and then Futurama and so on. So I ended up specializing in animation, but it's just the way the dice rolled, really.
Have you branched off and done pilots for live-action stuff?
I've written a few pilots that were – one of them I'm having trouble remembering. I think one of them started out being animated but then was going to be live-action for HBO. It was based on this – comic book Peep Show by Joe Matt. Are you familiar with that?
Mm-hmm.
It's collected as The Poor Bastard. It's absolutely brilliant and, you know, hilarious and heartbreaking autobiographical stuff by this cartoonist Joe Matt. And so we wrote a pilot for HBO for that with him and this other writer, Donna Carey from The Simpsons. I think that was going to be live action, but it was still based on a comic book. So, and then I wrote a pilot, another animated pilot that was going to star Ice Cube.
What?
It was called Grandmaster Freak and the Furious 15.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of based on my childhood in Englewood, New Jersey, which was the home of Sugar Hill Records.
Oh, wow.
The Sugar Hill Gang recorded.
Yes, of course.
So it's going to take place in the early days of rap music in this oversized rap group with 15 members. So that was just, you know, had way too many people, but... That didn't make it to the area. That was for Fox. So I think I might have written another. I'm trying to remember. Boy, it's been a while. You can't. I think I might have written one more, but I already forgot. I don't think. Maybe. I guess it was just those two.
I was just thinking about. This is not any type of linear part of the conversation. This is going to go way back to what we were talking before, but I was just remembering when we were talking about putting the commercials for the game and that someone has to pay for stuff. And as much of an animation person as I am, I only just found out, and I feel stupid for only just finding this out, but all of the original Warner Brothers animated cartoons were essentially made to promote Warner Brothers' music catalog. And I had no idea.
Me neither.
That's why it was Looney Tunes and Merry Melodies. That was all in the Warner Brothers music catalog. And so they would make these cartoons to promote just their vast
catalog. Isn't it funny? Just the idea that people were going out, they were just to buy, I don't know, the Blue Danube or whatever. It's kind of funny, isn't it? Like that.
Yeah.
But, you can sell a million records with this cartoon.
Yeah, well, but it was at a time where I'm sure, you know, that was incredibly technologically advanced. It was like, you can capture a recording of someone right. doing something and just listen to that thing? That's crazy.
That's another business which has just been gone through 10,000 iterations in our own lifetime, to the point that you can bring one up that makes no sense to either of us even, but music being utterly different. And my daughter is mystified by these giant, I have one of those milk crates of records down in the basement.
Yes.
It weighs 500 pounds. Like, yes. You can listen to that? How? And like, but you have to take my word for it, because there's no longer any way to listen to it. But
so now they're just sitting in a crate.
But I can't throw them out. You know,
no.
Get those Led Zeppelin albums with the, you know, the paper bag and the rotating wheel.
You should get a turntable.
I guess I should.
It's time. Turntables are shockingly expensive. There's a you'd think they'd be like $10.
They have, I mean,
but they're hundreds and hundreds of dollars.
Actually, you know. We actually even have talked a couple times about a Futurama album, because they're, which I think would be fun to put out on vinyl, because there's all these cool vinyl technologies now that I didn't used to know about, where you can have, they put like, you know, two tracks on there, and depending on where the needle starts, you have a completely different record, because they're two spirals nested.
Oh, that's genius.
Or there's, I think somebody did a record where there's a track on the cardboard in the middle.
Yep.
And there's all these cool things you can do.
Can I pitch you an idea for that?
Yeah.
Oh, you got to have Bender do like a Wolfman Jack, like Wolfman Bender. Wolfman Bender is essentially, he would be the DJ that would be bringing you all of those songs, that whatever those songs, and maybe it's just all weird song parodies.
Well, we have enough songs from the show that we could probably crank out one album, but I would anyone buy it? I don't know. It's like the Merry Melodies situation at that point, where you're trying to use a cartoon to sell music, which we've already given away.
Yeah, but that's why, if you can justify it in a way where you print like, you know, 1,000 of them or something, and then they're promotional for something else. I mean, it sounds like Futurama Worlds of Tomorrow is super fun, by the way. I've been playing it since it launched.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, and I think the writing, which again, we have a bunch of the real writers working on it, and I've been playing it also to keep an eye on things. I was involved in the initial writing of the animation at the beginning and kind of the general concept and stuff, and I'm just sort of keeping an eye on it now. But I think the writing's getting better and better and better, and I keep finding myself laughing out loud now. So
because yes, it's dynamic, because it doesn't –
it also evolves. They're writing every day. Like the model for these games, these mobile games, is it's insane amount of work, because there's literally every day new material is being written, and you know, it's never ending.
Game.
Yeah, because the appeal of it partly is there's always a story going on in the game, and every time you get a new character in the game, there's a new story with that character, or there's events. There's going to be, if it's still going on, depending on when this is, there's an event based on the podcast,
right?
The podcast episode we did, and we'll incorporate those characters. So things from real, unlike the animation, things from real life can be incorporated very fast into the game. So, you know, if we want to refer to this podcast, okay, those characters are in tomorrow, as long as our writers drink a lot of coffee and stay up all night.
I have to thank you for letting me be involved in, first of all, letting me be a head in the game, like a head in a jar is incredible. And then just for, you know, helping to make the podcast thing happen and then letting me be in it. I really, really, really appreciate it.
Well, thank you. As I said, you were instrumental in making it happen. So
sweet.
Chris Hardwick, everybody.
Hey, come on, you guys. Oh, please, everyone, take it down a notch. Is there anything else that you're excited about now that you're working on? Or
Well, I can now say, you know, this has been top secret for like 18 months or something like that, but it's finally just been announced that Matt Groening has a new show in the works. And I for Netflix. I can't say too much about it. I'm not the boss at that show, but I am writing for it. It's called Disenchantment. It's a takes place in a medieval type fantasy world, and Josh Weinstein, who ran The Simpsons with Bill Oakley in some of the golden years, is the head writer, executive producer, showrunner of that, working with Matt. So it's pretty fun. So, but about a year off, probably still. But get ready.
Fantastic. So Disenchantment, Futurama Worlds of Tomorrow, which is mobile for iOS and Android. And then also the Radiorama, the Futurama podcast episode, which is available now on Nerdist.
Listen to it twice.
Listen to it as many times as you feel like you should listen to it. But thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you. That was a blessed.
Real pleasure. And, you know, let me know if it ever seems like Futurama is creeping back up. Please let me know. I will, even if I just come and watch a recording or something, I'd love to do that.
You'll be the first to hear.
Thank you.
I'll call you, then I'll call Matt Groening.
Yeah. that'd be really great if I got the call before Matt. I'm sure that would be okay, right?
If you see a real estate agent coming through here, like, Matt Groening's looking for offices. Bad sign for you and a good sign for us.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Enjoy your burrito, everyone. The end.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
This episode brought to you by the HBO comedy special Felipe Esparza, Translate This. So there's a new hour stand-up comedy by Felipe, which has a lot of unconventional riffs on immigration and sharing stories about translating for his parents as a kid, how his father got their family from the United States to Mexico, and then becoming a father himself while still in high school, all performed in English with Spanish peppered throughout. Felipe Esparza, Translate This on HBO and HBO Latino Saturday, September 30th at 10 p.m.
Enhance your listening experience with Wondery Plus. Enjoy ad-free listening, exclusive content, binges, and more. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.